My name is Julie Whitaker. I manage social media for Doctors Without Borders, the U.S. office, which is in New York City. And we always have electricity and internet connection. So with these guys that are going to be talking today, that's not always the case. So first I have Kate, who's the communications and program manager at WAHA International, and they deal with maternal health in disadvantaged communities around the world. And she's going to give a case study of SMS medical records that they've been using. And then I have Ivan and Pablo. And Ivan is a logistician with Doctors Without Borders. I'll let him explain what a logistician is. And Ivan is a software engineer at Google and also the founding member.
Pablo's a software.
Sorry, Pablo. Ivan is not both of those things. Pablo is a software engineer at Google and the founding member of Google.org's crisis response team. And they worked together in Haiti when there was a cholera outbreak last year doing some mapping around the work that we were doing there. A few notes on acronyms. Doctors Without Borders is known by its French name, Médecins Sans Frontières, in most of the places where we work. So you're going to hear us talking about MSF a lot, and that is Doctors Without Borders. CTC is a cholera treatment center. Any other? I think those are the main ones. So I wanted to, before we get started, I wanted to do a quick poll of the audience. How many people here work in settings that have serious tech constraints? Aid workers in the field, perhaps. Okay. And then how many people here are tech people who want to help solve some of the problems that those people might be facing? Awesome. Okay. That's great. Thanks for coming. Really appreciate having you here. I'll be watching the Twitter stream to see if there's questions on there. I encourage that you guys to use that to connect with each other. We'll take questions at the end. So I'll hand it over to Kate.
Okay. Hi. Can you hear me? Yeah. That's good. Can you put them? Okay. So I'm Kate, and I work with WAHA, which stands for Women and Health Alliance International. And we work on maternal health care issues, mainly in sub-Saharan Africa, where there are quite high mortality rates. There's around 1,000 women who die each day in a pregnancy or childbirth, and most of the deaths occur while women are giving birth or shortly after. So we've really focused our work on helping women get the medical care they need when they're giving birth. And in helping them, partnering with local communities and local organizations to help them overcome the main barriers they face in accessing that care. So on the one hand, we'll strengthen the local infrastructure, and on the other hand, we'll do things like, you can see in the next picture, we work with what are called locally in Senegal community godmothers. You can see them on the right hand, there, corner. And they're basically community relays. They're selected, chosen, voted in by their community to act as information relays on issues concerning maternal health or child health. And this was something that already existed, and we just helped to activate it a bit more and provide them with mobile phones so they could use that to call the health center if the pregnant women had questions around their pregnancy, because these are quite isolated regions. It's a rural sector, so they're not just going to like pop into the health center for a question. It takes time to get there. It requires resources. There's little transport infrastructure. So the mobile phones with these women was a way of just introducing some exchange of information. But crucially, it was also when the woman went into labor, they would call the motorbike ambulance you see there so they could take the women to the health center. So that's pretty basic. That does not sound like new technology, but there it was. It was the first time they were doing this, even though there was already mobile phone coverage. And a lot of the solutions we look at are actually structural issues that help everyone. Even though we're focusing on women, it'll help the children who are sick too, who need to be transferred. And one of the main issues in this sense, one of the main gaps we've found is that there's a huge lack in personal medical records, in patient medical records, and patient medical history. Now, can you go to the next? Mm-hmm. Now, we use that in the projects where we work, in the hospitals we work in. Doctors Without Borders will have that in their hospitals. Different organizations use patient medical records. But it's pretty exceptional when you look at the health system as a whole. They're practically non-existent. they're not filled in properly. The information isn't transferred from one service to another service within the same hospital, let alone between different health structures. So a woman who had some complication during her delivery in one health center and then goes to another health center for her next delivery, her medical history won't be there, so they won't necessarily deal with the patient properly. There's risk of misdiagnosis, of bad management, and also duplication, like during vaccination campaigns, et cetera. And we are talking about high disease burden settings where, like, for instance, in Niger, almost every year there are a high load case of malnutrition, of acute malnutrition. There are peaks in malaria, and depending on the season. So it's really a lot of disease cases and no medical record, no medical history of the patients in most cases. So on the one hand, we had that huge gap. And then on the other hand, which I guess you're all very well aware about, is the huge mobile boom in Africa, which has today, I think the latest figures are 640 million mobile phone users or subscriptions over a total population of 1 billion people in Africa in general. Can you go to the next slide? And these sorts of graphs, every year I see them, they're actually, each year they try and estimate what are the forecasts for the following years, and each year they underestimate them. And the following year they have to bring them up, because it's just huge. It's the continent that has the highest growth in mobile phone coverage. And I think one of the reasons is that in most areas in Africa, especially in the rural sector, but even in some of the main cities, there was no other form of communication before. Like, landlines were not really used, or they were bad quality. I think in the Congo, like, they had 1,000 landlines before, and that was it. And that was mainly in Kinshasa, Lubumbashi, the main cities. So this is like, you have to imagine something like Little House on the Prairie, where there's nothing, and suddenly everyone has mobile phones. So how would that affect how they deal with their everyday issues, but how they deal with emergencies too? And when I was in the Congo, in fact, I saw that difference in one of the areas in eastern Congo where there's an armed conflict for over a decade, and there are lots of different armed groups fighting, and every now and then they'll go in and loot some villages. And when mobile phone coverage came along, it changed the way people would deal with those issues, because, you know, it just happened naturally. They can call their neighbors, they can call the neighboring villages, tell them what's going on. They would call the hospital from the health center, the nurses, and say, you know, we've fled the health center, they're looting it, we're hiding here and here, we have some patients who need to be hospitalized, can you help me bring them? And if they didn't have any money on their phones, they just beep you, they call you, and then you call them back. And this just happened very naturally. It wasn't any organization coming in saying, oh, I have a great idea. Just happened naturally, like it happens here. So it's changed the way people deal, I think, with their everyday life, but also with emergencies and in natural disasters. We often don't mention enough the importance of information during a crisis, that people should get enough information on where their loved ones are, where their family is, where they're hiding, whether they're injured, whether they've been killed. And it's often the first thing that people want to know, like any of you would want to know. And also information on where to go for help. So as long as the mobile phone network is still up, those are things that we can do now which we couldn't before in some of these areas. So could you go to the next slide? So there's also a lot of applications that have come out from within different African countries. There's ICAO, for instance, in Kenya, which... I don't know how popular it is, but I really like the icon, actually. It's used by farmers to manage their livestock. There's a really interesting one called Ushahidi that's on the far right there, so your left, which started in 2008 during some election violence in Kenya when a girl was blogging about the things she was seeing. And lots of people commented on her blog what they were seeing. So they started mapping it out, and they could map it out using text messages. And now Shahidi has grown, and they're using it in other countries. And in fact, it was used in Washington, D.C. and in New York after a snowstorm, so people could map out which streets they were cleaning out, and they could coordinate like citizen action. And the truth is that when there is a natural disaster or a man-made disaster, generally the first people who will give the life-saving assistance or who will deal with the situation are just the ordinary citizens like you and me who are living in the area until the aid actors or the government or whatever come in. So these sorts of tools can be very useful for that. There's just two more examples. MoTeC, which is actually funded by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation in Ghana, carried out by the Grameen Foundation. And they have applications like one called Mobile Midwife, where pregnant women can subscribe to the service, and they will send messages tailored to the pregnant woman's need, like they know she's 4 months pregnant and it's time to go for an antenatal consultation, so she'll receive a message like, oh, have you been to your antenatal consultation? Don't forget. And then if she doesn't go, they'll send another message to remind her, oh, you didn't come. And the messaging, they're audio messages, because in a lot of these areas, in the rural sector, the women are illiterate, so the text messaging is not necessarily going to work. And there are lots of different languages, so they're audio messages tailored to the specific language or dialect in that region. And the really one that I think has had a huge impact, M-Pesa. Pesa means money in Swahili, and it's just a method for transferring money using text messages. And it's really popular in Kenya, in Somalia. We used it ourselves in our programs in Somalia to help women pay their transport fees so they could come to the hospital for obstetric fistula surgery because they were coming from really far away. And that has been really great because a lot of people don't have bank accounts. You don't need to have a bank account to use that. You just need to have a mobile phone. And a lot of transfer of money is carried out that way now. In fact, at one point, the Al-Shabaab, one of the main group controlling part of an area in Somalia, you know, prohibited the use of this sort of money transfer because they couldn't control it because it was having quite a big impact. But now I think it's back on. But anyway, we were saying, you know, we need some personal health records. And on the other hand, there's all this mobile phone boom. So can we find a way to combine the both, knowing that it has to be text adapted? It can't be based on 3G technology, which isn't out there everywhere. That the information can't be saved on the phone or on the SIM card because that gets lost. And sometimes there's only one phone per family, and it's not the woman necessarily who's going to have it on her all the time, but the husband. And we hooked up with Microsoft Health Vault to see how we could transfer that, and that's where we're at now. Oh. Looking at how they can convert Health Vault so it would work via an SMS gateway together with a local mobile phone provider, Orange, in Senegal. So the ideal situation would be a mother goes to the health center during a vaccination campaign and sends a code through her phone to retrieve the vaccination history of her kid, and the health worker can then see, does he need a vaccination or not, provides the vaccination, then just updates the information. So it sounds pretty straightforward, but none of that exists yet. So the stage we're at right now is basically, it's a technical issue now with Orange and Microsoft and the Ministry of Health, who's very interested because there's a whole series of applications we can add to that platform in order to monitor in real time what's going on, which would help, for instance, if in a health center they get many children who have a measles, they can say, aha, there's a problem there, and react immediately, not necessarily the Ministry of Health, but any of the other health actors who may be in the region, such as ourselves or Doctors Without Borders or whoever's working there. The interesting thing about it is it's also a lot of the initiatives that have been carried out so far in mHealth have been really linked to one project, like an AIDS program just for the AIDS patients or for TB. But this would be something global that in the end could benefit, could be carried out on a national level once, you know, once we've tried it in Senegal. I think the thing that is key is that this stuff will work if people, the users, actually find it directly useful. If it's just to gather data, they're not going to find it useful. So the patients have to see the use in it. They're going to have control over their own personal health records. They're actually going to have personal health records, which they didn't have before. And they're going to be able to access it when they want. And I think that's the key thing. And just another thing I found was really interesting about the whole mobile phone boom in Africa is that there is a tendency with maternal healthcare issues to say that a lot of the problems are cultural. So for instance, women, they don't go and give birth at a health center because it's not part of their culture. Traditionally, they have to give birth at home. But you know, it wasn't part of anyone's culture before to have mobile phones, but it's boomed. I think one of the main reasons women don't give birth in a health center is because a health center doesn't work, because it's 3 days walk away, because they don't have any information on what is working. And for me, the argument of seeing how the mobile phone industry has just exploded in Africa, it just goes to show that a lot of it is more about practical issues, and people will use things that work, basically. So I guess I would leave it there, unless you want to have any questions now or we go ahead with Pablo. It's just an introduction.
Well, let's take questions for both at the end.
Okay. Oh, Senegal. Well, that's the region where we're going to do the pilot project. The one that's colored in is called Kédougou. It's one of the poorest areas of Senegal. It has double the maternal death rates than the national average. It has about 150 to 200,000 people. So it's sparsely populated, but everyone's very spread out. It's mostly a rural sector. So the challenge will be bringing it to a sector like that, and not just to a main city where you have a lot of people concentrated in one area. That'll be really the main challenge.
Thanks, Kit. All right. Hi. I'm Ivan, and I work with Doctors Without Borders. From now on, I'll refer to it as MSF, Médecins Sans Frontières, because that's what I'll remember. Otherwise, I'll be spouting confusing acronyms. So I was in Haiti after the earthquake, and I was the first emergency coordinator for MSF in when the cholera broke out. Now, everyone knows about the earthquake in Haiti, and that was an absolutely extraordinary event. I mean, there are estimates that range between 80,000 and 300,000 people that died there in a 35-second earthquake. To put that in perspective, that's a lot like Hiroshima and Nagasaki put together. It's something that was not only massive in scale, but it was compressed in both space and in time. It was a 35-second earthquake, and it happened in basically one city. Unfortunately, the capital city, where a third of the population of the country lives. So you have already a country, Haiti, which is an absolute blight on the conscience of humanity in the sense that it's in the midst of the Western Hemisphere, and it's got health indicators that would be considered poor in a lot of places in sub-Saharan Africa. It is a shocking incidence of really poor socioeconomic and health indicators right next to Florida, Cuba, the Dominican Republic, places where people don't have to suffer from diseases like cholera because they have things like sinks and toilets. So a quick introduction of who we are. MSF is a private emergency humanitarian medical organization, private in the sense that we're not connected either to governments or to the United Nations system. We're actually just an association of people who give money and go and volunteer to do stuff in the field. We're pretty large in scale now. Since 1971, we've scaled up to about 80 different countries. And we have a really well-known reputation in the humanitarian community as being arrogant, standoffish bastards. And that probably has to do with the fact that we're arrogant, standoffish bastards, because one of the things that comes with our sort of principle of independence is that we don't play well with others. And that will tie later into how we managed to do a collaboration with Google, whose very raison d'être is about being able to play with others and make people cooperate together or help people to cooperate together. In any case, Haiti in 2010-2011 was the biggest project we'd ever taken on ever. It was enormous in scale. First of all, we had the earthquake response, and then we had the cholera response. Cholera, for those of you who don't know what it is, it's a bacterial disease which is transmitted by the fecal-oral route. In other words, if you get a little bit of the bacteria which is passed in feces into your digestive system, then it can grow and you can develop basically a whole lot of diarrhea and a whole lot of vomiting. It doesn't do all that much to you except make you have really copious diarrhea and vomiting. And if you don't die from that, then you get better in a couple of days. The body is very easily capable of dealing with the Vibrio bacteria. However, in the meantime, you tend to dehydrate and your system collapses and you die. So the treatment for cholera is dead simple. You just have to rehydrate the person orally if they're able to take oral, and intravenously if they can't take oral. So more or less, the treatment for cholera is water. Okay, with a few electrolytes and some intravenous equipment and some sterilization. But basically, it's keeping people hydrated until their system deals with the infection. You're in and out in 3 days. You usually come out with absolutely no particular damage afterwards. If you survive, you're usually just fine. But it can spread like wildfire. It typically will attack about 5% of a given population. And the mortality of the strain in Haiti without treatment is about 40%. So it hits a country. Haiti made a lot of firsts that year. First of all, they had that enormous earthquake, and then they had this cholera epidemic, which was an introduction of cholera into an epidemiologically naive country. There hadn't been cholera in Haiti for 100 years. Not because it wasn't ripe for it. It should have had cholera a long time ago, but it was epidemiologically isolated. It's next to wealthy countries with sinks and toilets. Had Haiti been next to Sierra Leone, it would have had cholera a long time ago. But because it was isolated, it didn't. When it did get cholera, it was catastrophic. Not only was the population, they didn't have immunity because they'd never had it before, they also didn't have any systems to deal with it. The health system didn't know how to deal with cholera. The people themselves didn't know what to do with it. People in Congo, when they get cholera, they know. This is not a totally unfamiliar thing. They know to get to a healthcare center. In Haiti, it might as well have been Ebola. People were terrified. Some people were actually killed because they were, feared to be cholera carriers. That actually doesn't help to kill the person. In fact, that usually winds up just spreading it more. So it was a really difficult event. It was the largest intervention we'd ever done. We brought in hundreds and hundreds of expatriates, and we had thousands of national staff. In the first 2.5 months of that cholera epidemic, there were 200,000 cases that we know of. We, Doctors Without Borders, treated 110,000 of them. The Cuban Brigade treated another 50,000. And the West of the world combined, including the United Nations, the government, and every other NGO in the world, treated the remaining 20%. So when they released their reports about the coordinated cholera response, which doesn't include Doctors Without Borders and the Cuban Brigade, they're talking about 20% of the response. We were more than half of it for those first 2.5 months. We treated 110,000 cases of cholera in 2.5 months. And, well, in terms of our own capacity, basically at this point we had posters up in Paris saying, volunteer for Doctors Without Borders, minimum 1 month commitment, no experience necessary. Not only were we at the bottom of the barrel, we were rooting through the trash. I mean, we were absolutely out of capacity. There was no way we could bring in any more useful capacity to treat the cholera. So it became extremely important to know where we needed to be in order to address the situation. So I walk through my office one day, and I notice the epidemiologist who's hand-placing pins on a Google Earth map, and I thought, there has to be a better way to do this. Who recognizes this? A few people. This is John Snow's cholera map from London in 1860. This was a guy who's widely considered to be the father of epidemiology. He's a strong candidate for the greatest physician, doctor in history. And his claim to fame, to my great joy, since I'm not a doctor or even a health professional, but I like maps, is that the guy who's the candidate for the greatest physician in history, his claim to fame is a map. What he did, and this is sort of a modern updating of his map, is he took a cholera epidemic that was happening in London. He mapped the households that had gotten cholera. He figured out where they were taking their water from. At one point, he actually had an outlying household that was way into a neighborhood that hadn't had much cholera, but turns out they were taking their water from the Broad Street pump in London. He figured out where the cholera had come from, and he padlocked the pump. Now, that was widely considered to be the first practical use of the germ theory of disease, which is hugely significant. And it was also widely considered to be the beginning of modern epidemiology. Now, one caveat, most epidemiologists today will say, yeah, well, he didn't actually accomplish anything. He padlocked the pump at the far end of the curve. The cholera was already peaked, and it was going down anyway. Nevertheless, we still think that mapping is potentially a way to really have a better impact and use the resources you have more efficiently. And to this day, you can still go to London, and across from the John Snow pub, you can see the Broad Street pump with John Snow's padlock on it. And I think if John Snow was alive today, he would be looking at the tools that we have and going, we can do this. We can look at maps, map the information we already have, organize the information we already have, and improve our response and save lives. So I think maps can save lives. So I called our New York office and said, can you contact Google and see if they can have a little, you know, Google Earth import that says, you know, in Google Earth, import cholera data. And my friend Pablo here got the call.
I was in a team that had recently spun up at Google based off the Haitian earthquake as well. And I'll just give you a brief background of that so you know why I got that call. I was working on search infrastructure on a product called real-time search, which allowed you to see tweets stream into your results as they happen on the net without you having to research all the time. No clue about humanitarian work or anything. I was just looking for cool examples of real-time events happening in the world to see how cool my system was. Then the Haitian earthquake struck, and we're like, ooh, news event. It wasn't really clear what was going on at that time. We were just like seeing if we scooped the New York Times or not. And quickly became clear that something much more important was going on. And as we saw the tweets coming in, we saw folks really worrying about their families. And we were sitting there just watching it, feeling like we weren't working on the right thing. And Google being a really cool company, we're allowed to kind of bank up. About one day a week, you get a bank up and eventually, you know, spend a couple weeks doing something you like working on as a new project. And so a bunch of people volunteered in the New York office and then also in Mountain View to pick up an old project that we had had after Katrina and before that after 9/11 to track basically missing people or status reports about family members. We'd called it Person Finder before, and we looked at the old code base and realized very quickly that it would take us too long to bring the old system up, so we just started writing it from scratch. We got one stood up in about 24, 48 hours and started exchanging very small updates between systems. The State Department asked us to play kind of a hub role on it, and so we made the databases of like CNN and New York Times. A lot of sites were popping up in Canada, basically where the Haitian diaspora were along the east coast of the U.S., made them synchronized in real time. So if you're a Haitian family member, you didn't have to worry then where to go to find the report. Integrated this streams down into Ushahidi at some point as well. And Patrick Meyer is sitting here very quietly in the audience. Patrick. And created a system that had existed after the fact, in previous disasters, after the fact, in Katrina and in 9/11. We did it in real time, much to everyone's shock. We had no idea that this was a big deal. But it was a big deal to share data in real time about a disaster using a rough and ready solution, you know, running code and rough agreement, as we say in the geek world. This was a great prototype. People were like, hey, you should probably do this more. Why don't you look at this? And so we went down to Haiti and asked people to watch over their shoulders as they triaged the disaster. Very quickly found out that all of our assumptions for the kind of technologies we could apply and the right way to approach this as good engineers, all those assumptions had serious flaws in them. And together, the sum of those assumptions made it so that we couldn't actually do anything. Nothing very substantial, we thought. And so we went back to the drawing board, and we were on the drawing board when Ivan pinged us to come down and take a look. We told him at first, though, clearly you have not read all of our copious documentation and great solutions that are up in the cloud. We have great mapping tools like Fusion Tables that you should just plug your data into. He wanted something to import his statistics into and get them on Google Earth. And we're like, oh, there's this thing called Fusion Tables, and you should go use it. And he's like, oh, yeah, I just tried that. It doesn't work. Our internet connection doesn't work very well. We're like, we'll just wait, or, you know, it should work fine. And we kept on trying to bounce around. Thought we were busy, and Ivan was trying to tell us something very important about how things actually work in these environments. So we went down and visited. And Haiti's a really interesting place, 2 hours from Miami. They have WiMAX in Port-au-Prince that puts a shame to the kind of connectivity that you can get in New York. You can stand up a wireless router that can stream YouTube to the middle of an IDP, internally displaced person camp in Haiti, in a way that I don't think we'll probably have in Central Park for a decade. But at the same time, the quality of the internet there is not the same. Occasionally, you're able to watch a YouTube video. Sometimes you're not. And the reliability starts off as an annoyance, but you quickly realize you can't build kind of a mashup of systems that expect the cloud to be there, that expect DNS to be there. And for the systems engineers in the group, it's just the difference between, say, 99.9% uptime and 98% uptime. All of our architectures fall apart, and we quickly have to go back to the drawing board. And so that's my role for the next, you know, 10, 15 minutes here, is to basically bring home a message to all the technologists in the room of, we need to rethink these things. And it's not just for humanitarian work. I mean, humanitarian work is totally fulfilling work. We should all do it. But I will tell you that these technologies are broken in the New York City subway, at least on Android, my good old company's solution. When I go down and I want to search my emails, I can't search my emails because I don't have an internet connection, even though they're already on my phone. I just want to look at the emails I have on my phone. The search functionality has been basically delegated to a cloud-based solution, and so I'm stuck without that. And this is the same way that things kind of break down. It's death by a thousand cuts. You cannot actually use the cloud in much of the developing world, or sometimes even in the developed world, because our architectures are too coyly associated with life in Silicon Valley. You know, the world isn't just Silicon Valley. It's more diverse and much more broken in interesting ways than we like to admit. So you can read down. These are just to kind of stand up there and browse through while we speak. But I'll give it back to Ivan.
So when Pablo and his colleague came, the first thing we asked them to do was take a look at we had an issue with water points. We knew that a lot of the water systems in Port-au-Prince, in the capital city, were badly broken. And color is intimately associated with water systems. If there's not clean water, things are bad. And the particular key is chlorination. If the water is chlorinated, a normal dose of chlorine like you'd have in the water here will kill the cholera bacteria. That's one of the reasons why you can have a raging epidemic 2 hours from Miami and three cases in Miami, all of whom came from Haiti itself. It just doesn't spread as long as there's chlorinated water. So in theory, it shouldn't be that complicated to have chlorinated water. Unfortunately, it just doesn't work all the time. So Pablo and his colleagues came and did us a map of all of the water systems. Now, Pablo, if you could quickly, while I get this going, tell the story of the of how you came and set up the water sampling.
So this talk was kind of advertised incorrectly. We it was called New Technologies for Humanitarian Aid, but one of the big learnings we had was that some old technologies really shine. To make this map, on the way down to Haiti to meet Ivan, I stopped at Best Buy and asked them for all their GPS units. And then somebody else who was coming down stopped at Target and asked for their pool testing kits, the chlorine pool testing kits. All of a sudden, you have you know, an infrastructure capacity capability map that the government of Haiti and the UN, I don't want to point too many fingers, that's Ivan's job, weren't able to stand up, and we stood it up in an afternoon. I taught by reading the directions on the back of the corn testing kit, taught a few guys who knew the neighborhoods how to use them as well, and then on the plane ride down, I read the user's manual on the GPS units and figured out the simplest way to get them to get waypoint information. It's like, hey guys, take a reading off this little chlorine tester thing, and then on the clipboard, write down the serial number that you get when you push the waypoint button on your GPS, and then later on we'll figure it out. And so sent them off on motorbikes into the neighborhoods where they were from, so they knew them very well. And you'd get a few, they were basically just going where people were getting their water, going to the trucks that were dropping the water, or plumbing-based water, and just testing it. And then we take it, and by the end of the week, we had maybe 2 weeks, we had this map of Carrefour, which is a western cluster of Port-au-Prince.
So this map here is what Pablo and his colleagues generated for us, and green dots indicate sufficient chlorine to kill the Vibrio, the bacteria. Purple dots indicate too much chlorine, which in the short term simply means bad taste. It's not going to hurt you to have a bit too much chlorine for a couple of weeks. It would if you did for years. And red indicates not enough chlorine to kill the bacteria. So clearly, things aren't so good. Now, this map here, the nice thing about it was generated from very, very simple technology, just a handheld Garmin. As Pablo said, clipboards. We didn't even download the data from the Garmin necessarily, just write down the waypoint. And this meant that basically really low-trained, low-skill workers, but guys who knew the area really well, were able to collect the data. And in an evening, Pablo's colleague, Kaping Yi, hacked up a little machine that takes a spreadsheet and turns into a Google Earth map that you can click on and get the information. So, well, where's my problem with my... with my water? Here we have, and this is the other thing that was hacked up in a single evening by the Google guy. This is a quick animation of the cholera register from our cholera treatment center. Now, this is what it looks like. This is just a very simple spreadsheet, which, by the way, is anonymized. None of these are patient ID numbers, not actual patient names. But what we have here is the list of all the patients that came into a cholera treatment center, and where they came from, the neighborhood that they came from. Before coming to Haiti, Pablo looked on OpenStreetMap and found the names of all of most of these neighborhoods. 70% of them were identified before they actually came to the field, and so we were able to make this map, which is a representation of the cholera cases day by day in the cholera treatment center in Carrefour. Now, the really interesting thing here is we come up to the 11th of December when there was a water outage in three neighborhoods, and 5 days later there was an enormous spike in cholera. So on the 11th of December we have a water outage, and by the 16th of December in these neighborhoods, the lower center neighborhoods, we had a noticeable spike in cholera.
Is that visible? Can you guys see the X's? It's a little low contrast. Okay.
Yeah. So we actually were able to take that map instantly to UNICEF and the water authority of Port-au-Prince, of the Haitian capital, and say, you had a water outage, and we had a lot more patients. People are dying. We need action now. UNICEF's initial response was, well, it's not our responsibility. It's somebody else's problem. We more or less did our usual arrogant bastards thing, screamed and yelled. I gave the water utility the first $5,000 to put fuel in their trucks to go and fix their water system, and UNICEF took up the slack thereafter. They started paying for those water trucking, and they're still probably arguing back and forth as to who's responsible for paying for the trucks to fix the water system. But I don't care. I just want it done in the midst of a cholera epidemic. This is not the time to discuss who's responsible for what, or make strategic partnerships, or plan for the future. So we took that map as well as this, which demonstrates the chlorination level in all of the water sources of the city. And so even though this hadn't achieved that Jon Snow dream that I have of trying to get our responses in real time, to know where the cholera is starting to peak and get there before it does, this actually turned out all of a sudden to be a really powerful advocacy tool where I could show viscerally and visually what's needed and convince someone else to take their responsibilities. That was really, really useful already. So that was already a sort of massive immediate utility for us. Now, there are a couple other things. This is not a really complicated or sophisticated thing. As Pablo said, we might have a slightly misnamed seminar here. We're saying adapting new technologies. Doctors Without Borders just migrated to Microsoft XP, to Windows XP. So we just came from Windows 2000 to Windows XP. That was
us. But to Kate's point, I think what's interesting here is that these are new technologies in different places, right? I think that's part of the thing that we have to start thinking about is, you know, do we need another Twitter real-time search thing to find out about Britney Spears or sorry, Gaga or whatever it is these days? Or, you know, at some point start to review our architectures, review our tools and the usage of them to make them more applicable for the next couple billion people who are getting online. So, you know, it is new technology, and keep that in mind for a lot of people.
This is another example of a spreadsheet, which is, I mean, we exchange most of our information in spreadsheets. This is actually from the United Nations cluster system, and it's basically just a list of all of the cholera treatment centers. So if you're running a cholera treatment center and you have too many patients, you're swamped, you can look through here and you can contact whoever it is that you need to contact to get some help. Now, with this tool that Google hacked up in an afternoon, well, actually what I can do is take a look at this map, which shows all, it's actually generated from that same spreadsheet. You take that spreadsheet, you fire it through this little import tool, and now that's what that cholera treatment center is there. So specifically, I'm sitting in Port-au-Prince. This is my cholera treatment center here. I'm full. Who can help me? Ah, well, Global Assistance Partners, and their phone number is... So effectively, it's the same information. There's no new information here. It's simply that I can suddenly take that information and filter out the stuff that's geographically irrelevant to me. A spreadsheet doesn't filter by proximity. It filters alphabetically or by size or whatever. Here, I've actually filtered that same spreadsheet in a way that I can look and go, well, that one is not relevant to me, but this one sure is.
And I do want to underscore, I didn't realize this before, but we actually, so we said Person Finder, oh, we have this great thing. Let's make another tool called, you know, Resource Finder, which would do exactly this. This was our use case. And we worked together with PAHO, Pan American Health Organization, which was basically an umbrella group to pull in a lot of others, and tried to implement a pretty complex standard known as EDXL have. It's an XML standard for exchanging medical facility information. We did implement it, and we actually came up with a system that works like this. But what's notable about it is it lived in the cloud, and nobody's using it now. We have it in our toolkit in the crisis response team, or those guys, you know, I don't work with them anywhere. But we thought that we had failed in a way because we knew that this was an open problem. How do you just exchange this basic facility information? Like something that we would take for granted if you're in New York, like tell me the restaurants on my block and like, are they good? You know, can I get a reservation or something like that? It's the same problem. But again, the systems break down when you try to apply it here. And that for the technologists, the lesson is that the tool that Google built to fix this just did not work, and part of the reason was people there just couldn't use it. And so Ivan here has this tool now that he's maintaining. We have an open source project we'll talk about at the end, which can be used totally disconnected from the internet using a backbone, not of the cloud, but a backbone of email, spreadsheets, and KML, just being sent around as attachments and re-imported, and maps being built when you need them completely offline.
And this is kind of the centerpiece in what I think is hopefully what's looking to the future and what, you know, we've got an epidemiological department in Doctors Without Borders called the Manson Unit, not for Charlie, but for the guy who wrote Manson's Tropical Diseases. And they're working on integrating more mapping and GIS into our work. And this particular show here, this is all of MSF's cholera patients in 2011. It starts with this huge outbreak throughout the country, goes down to the southern part of the country, then settles down, and this is what Haiti's going to look like for the next 200 years probably as it's endemic. Then it settles actually, whoops, rainy season, boom, boom, again. So again, we take a look at this. It starts with this incredible outbreak right at the foot of the Artibonite River. It spreads throughout the region. Somebody takes a boat down from the north down to the south. It breaks out again in the south, and then it settles. The rainy season's over, people have learned how to avoid cholera, there's a little more sort of hygiene happening, and people have acquired a certain amount of herd immunity, I don't mean that herd immunity is an epidemiological phrase. But then the rainy season comes, and whoop, and then it spreads person to person, and somebody goes up to visit grandma, and whoop, and then it hits south again. So now we've had that data in all kinds of formats, mostly spreadsheets and databases, but you can't see it. And it's actually really interesting to be able to visualize that kind of data set. And this is really primitive stuff. As Pablo said, this is spreadsheets, KML, all offline. Really, you know, the application of brand new technology as of about 1998.
But seriously, like, I've been at Google 6 years. I work on some of the biggest infrastructure systems we have in search. I was blown away what these guys can do with spreadsheets and email. And I just think it's a real pattern that we need to relearn some of our technology stacks, because, again, it doesn't even work in the New York City subway. And what you can do with this, like, it's the Unix philosophy of a bunch of small tools joined together. I think the cloud, in some cases, has just become too monolithic. And this is a leading edge in crisis situations for a topic that we probably should, as architects, revisit more generally.
Just a quick example of what I'm doing here. I open this little dumb Java tool, which is totally offline, and I open up an Excel file, which is the cholera treatment centers in Haiti. There's the list of the ones that were mislabeled, and here's all the cholera treatments in Haiti. Okay, let's say I want to actually vary the icon sizes by number of beds. Okay, let's take a look at that. Whoops, that's way too big, so we'll make it a little smaller. And, whoops, let's have a preview of that. Okay, that looks potentially usable. If I wanted the colors to be different, I'll just use number of beds again. Okay. And now that could be anything. I can create a KML file that's just going to show in Google Earth. And that's actually what generated that file from the spreadsheet of the... here's another one.
And this is what we basically told Ivan to go and use. This is what Fusion Tables does. Except he can now do this offline without access to the internet.
And then while we're going through these examples, if you have a question, raise your hand, and there's some wireless mics that are going to be passed around. And just make sure you get your question into the mic.
And here is how I take my cholera registry. And that has to sit there and grind away for a moment. That is every single cholera case that we treated in Carrefour for that particular time. And if I look at that in Google Earth here, oops, not that one. Here is one point in Google Earth for every single cholera patient that we had during that outbreak. And I can click on each one and actually see the person, and I can run it through time to see how things went day by day. Now, that actually helps me visualize things. Again, really, really simple tool. Just same data I had before, visualizing it differently. I don't know if we can see those dots dancing. Okay.
And then who has the... Are you guys ready for questions?
Questions. Yeah. So my name is Fred Trotter. I wrote the health IT book for O'Reilly, and I've been an open source health IT advocate for a long time. And one of the things that I've always seen is that everywhere outside the United States, really, open source and health IT is extraordinarily popular because it's locally controlled, works locally. The people who originally write the software don't necessarily know how it needs to be done. And all the stuff you guys are saying, in fact, you said open source a bunch of times. And then on the other hand, De Rivero, for the first time ever, I heard someone say use Health Vault, Microsoft Health Vault, outside of the United States. I've never heard anybody say that. Normally, people say OpenMRS when they talk about like the place in the cloud they're going to build. So it's a very interesting contrast between what the two people on the right are saying and then the kind of a different strategy that's going on. It's just kind of shocking me because on this slide, actually, I was going to point that out. Almost always I see use open source because you can take it and you can install something locally and get it working locally and you don't have to ask anybody. And if it's slightly wrong, which it so often is, you just fix it yourself. So it's a very interesting contrast. And as far as Google goes, probably the most significant event I have seen in health IT in the last 2 years is the fact that Google Health was and then was not. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what happens when Health Vault is and then is not, mm-hmm. and isn't kind of what you're saying almost totally opposite as far as the strategy goes? I mean, yeah. it seems pretty huge. So I was just wondering if you guys could talk about that.
So the last point on the geek takeaways is focus on the interchange formats. It's true. So one of the guys who went down to Haiti with me after 2 weeks after the earthquake, Ronnie Zeiger, was the PM for Google Health. And we've all kind of watched it. And he was also working on Google Body, which is a very cool project. It's true. I mean, we've reorganized a lot in the past year or so. A lot of things have changed. What we do with data is we try to make the data live a different life cycle than the application. So we change the applications, but we say you can still download your health records. I think the thing that's really important about that is it's the same way the internet works. The way the internet was built is to focus on the packet. Focus on the interchange format. Say, I will send you this packet, and I don't care what's sitting to the other end of this pipe, but here's the format for the packet that's coming across the wire to you. And if you can understand the specification for the packet, I don't care if you have a Microsoft system or PDP 11, whatever going on the other end, right? This is exactly what we did with Person Finder during the initial response to the earthquake. The format had been worked out during 9/11 and Katrina. It was a one-page XML spec hosted on zesty.ca. You know, it was IETF tracked, so it was, you know, somewhat legit looking. But basically, it was the simplicity and publicness of that single format, which let the geeks at the various organizations implement adapters very quickly and exchange information. The apps will change; they'll go away. We had a Person Finder app that we couldn't resuscitate in a short amount of time, so we just wrote a new one in the expectation that we could still use PFIF, Person Finder Interchange Format, from the last disaster. And like to me, that's the real backbone of these things. Like, again, it's the spreadsheet. A spreadsheet, it's not Excel. It's tabular data, and we know how to exchange tabular data. And if you can agree in advance what to name the columns, then you have yourself a rough and ready interchange system that kind of transcends all of these implementation problems, because everybody has that challenge. Does that make sense? Is that a good approach? Yeah, I mean, they work together. The open source, you know, if you like Python and I like Java, then we have a problem. Everybody basically knows how to exchange XML, and that's what ends up basically running these things. And so that's where I put my focus.
Have you any other questions?
I was just to add to that, I mean, I'm not, like, I don't really know about technology, programming, and et cetera. And it's more like just finding an adapted solution, whether that comes from open source, from Health Vault, or whoever. It's just who is ready to come here and work with us and adapt that to the needs we have. And the person you meet, or the company or the group you meet who has that immediately, you're like, okay, let's go for it, which is sort of what happened with them too. You know, it's more that dynamic. It's not really like almost like an ideological or philosophical choice, this is how we should do it. It's just practical. Mm. It's really, it has to be adapted to local, is it possible and how to do it, and we try it out.
No, and I didn't mean to make, but Chris really just was a question. I'd say
Microsoft Health Vault has contributed more towards the standardized exchange of healthcare data than any other large company that I can think of, precisely because they view open standards as a reasonable answer to this problem. So I don't have a problem with Microsoft Health Vault. I think those guys are wonderful. It's just, if you lose your connection to the cloud...
But that's the whole point of doing it via an SMS gateway. Mm. That was the whole point, that people who don't have 3G, who don't have internet, I mean, can just send the information with a text message. Mm-hmm. And they are actually active in Germany, I think, and a few countries in Europe. Just because you said,
And also, just to give another example where this the cooperation ends up working well, is, you know, Fusion Tables has a lot of the Google Fusion Table solution that we wanted Ivan to look at. Is a lot of the features are based around what people expect from ArcGIS from Esri, right? And so we built that because we're like, oh, now it's on the web. But then now Ivan goes back and now he's implementing his own standalone version now of Esri's tools that can work just for his particular needs. So it is very much about having just running code that solves the problem. And open source is great, but only because it furthers that end.
Sorry, in the back. So the tools that you've demonstrated here look really nice. Are they available somewhere to be used?
And the description that you've given of this Pony Express model of delivering data through the field is one I've seen used a bunch of times in different places. I suspect we've been in some of the same places. The question becomes one of how do we get out of that broken model? Is there portable satellite gear that you can use to help with the Pony Express, or how do you see the next evolution of this problem?
Well, I actually see the response to the Pony Express problem as learning to work within the constraints that we have. I mean, we're not going to ever have a proper backbone in South Sudan. It's just that simple. So we have to, I mean, when a guy like Pablo comes to Haiti with us, and Haiti is actually really well connected compared to South Sudan, that gives us a chance for them to see, okay, what would happen if I only had 89% connectivity? Well, now extrapolate down to 0.9% connectivity, and what are you going to need? I actually think that our model of not be early adopters, we're not going to jump into cloud stuff, we're not going to, you know, jump into sophisticated technology. What Kate's doing with, you know, using the backbones that really are there, SMS, We always talk about backbones. Doctors Without Borders uses HF radio. You know, hello, this is Ivan, India, Victor, Alpha, November, do you read me? The thing is, that can't be turned off when there's an attack. That doesn't go down when the central power system in the country goes down. It's not very nice. It's really unpleasant. It's really inconvenient, but it's a backbone. It never goes away. So in Africa, from nothing, I started in 2003 in Burundi. That was my first time to Africa. And I was basically, you know, 3.5 months out of contact with everyone outside of that little village. And now, I mean, I'm walking around with two or three cell phones and a satellite phone. There's no moment of my life in Africa, even in the darkest parts of the Congo, where I'm not always connected. So from 9 years ago when there was nothing, now there actually is a backbone. It's SMS, and it's there, it's reliable, and it's changed the way people live. That M-Pesa thing where people are sharing money over the internet, as late as 2006, I was in Central Africa. Yeah, there was a guy who went from Central Africa to Cameroon to sell his and his family's herds. So he moved 600 head of cattle. On the way back, the bus that he was riding on was hit by bandits. He begged them, please, don't take everything. This is all that my extended family has. And because he said that, they got so angry they shot both his kneecaps out. Now, this is a guy whose problem was he never could have a bank account. When he wants to sell his family's herds, he's traveling with $60,000 in cash through Africa. So the idea of, you know, a communication backbone that can be scaled to do stuff like cash transactions, that guy would still be alive today if there had been a way for him to move his money from the sale of his cattle back home. So, you know, these kinds of things, the answer that I would think for your question is, look what's actually there, what actually does exist as infrastructure and backbone, and learn to use it.
We also, I just put up the link to the code project that Ivan and I are working on together. It's not pretty, but you're welcome to check it out and help out.
So we have 2 minutes. One more question right here up front.
So that's what I'm curious about. What's next for MSF and Google? If you were able to map cholera in Haiti, what are you doing in the other 80 countries?
We need a one-minute answer.
Okay. Yeah, it's way harder to shut me up than to start me talking. Okay. We're going to roll out a tool very much like this. I don't think it's the tool that matters. It's the concept that matters. The particular implementation of the tool is terribly messy. But the idea of being able to share these open standards of data to try to use, everybody agree on, okay, we'll use an XML, KML standard to share our epidemiological data. We're going to try to do that throughout our organization. We're going to try to set it up such that it is possible for us to play with others a bit. We're still going to be a bit standoffish about that. But the dream that I have really is there's a lot of political interference in health. Scientific and medical people share information. That's the nature of scientific and medical people. Governments and politicians and even certain international structures manipulate, distort, and hide information for political reasons. There are a lot of countries where you can be thrown out for saying the word cholera. There are a lot of countries that deny the existence of HIV. Because we are a country that follows X religion, which prohibits extramarital marriage, there is no such thing as HIV. QED. Well, just providing ways for scientific, medical, and local people to share information has the potential to absolutely topple the power of these bastards to hide information, the power of people to manipulate health information for political reasons. That could be a world changer. That's what I'm dreaming with all of this, is let's set up standards that make it easy and simple for everyone using their own particular offline, off-the-cloud, personal implementation to share data in such a way that we all know more about health, and one of these days it's going to be impossible to deny the existence of cholera or HIV, and it's going to be impossible for people to say, oh no, we don't have a problem here, or we did our job properly and we did that vaccination campaign. No, you didn't. There are kids having measles here, and yet it's impossible if you've got a 90% vaccination rate, which you claim, which is not the case. So that's my dream.
And from the open source side and the technology side, I think we need to resist the temptation to try to pre-standardize or pre-design these things and get into the action with these guys. Try to work through rough running solutions that get the job done. That's the thing that worked in a number of these cases. Getting a tool that works doesn't have to be pretty. Just send some spreadsheets back and forth, send some XML back and forth. That should be the bar. We don't have to set up the new portal called savetheworld.org. It needs to be volunteerism and engagement with these guys. They need to pull us, and we need to push the technologies that will help them improve what they're doing.
All right. And with that, we're going to end.
Can I throw in one last one?
You have 20 seconds.
20 seconds. Okay. You said something about whether these tools are going to be available for everybody. Yes, but please help design them because they're really primitive, yes, and they really don't work very well. So anybody who wants to, yes, please actually help code it.
Did you want to answer something, Kate? All right. Thank you so much for coming, everyone. We hope you guys will find each other, connect, solve some problems. Thank you.